Hello, everybody, and we are live for Film Club. I hope you are all well, and I hope you've all survived this unprecedented heat wave. And by unprecedented heat wave, I mean, I hope you've all survived the British summertime at roughly 2 degrees hotter than it usually is. Yes, we have given up on COVID hysteria, and now it's all out climate hysteria. It hits above 30 degrees, and you'd think we were on the face of the sun. You know, you wouldn't think millions of Britons go to places like Spain, Portugal, Tenerife, Gran Canaria, Greece every year to get to temperatures even hotter than this, would you? No. Apparently, we're all melting, and some idiots said thousands are dying. So I hope you're all well. I hope you've survived. I hope you sat there covered in ice packs, because tonight is going to be a very hot stream and it might raise everyone's temperature just that little bit more. Now, obviously, we're live on Odyssey, which is our preferred platform. We are also live on DLive, which is another fine platform, but a little less free speech. And finally, we're live on RadioAlbin.com, which is 100% free speech, because it's the home of our good friend Sven Longshanks, who is a tireless crusader for this cause. Now, you might want to be involved in tonight's stream, because I've been really looking forward to this, and I didn't think I was going to be this hyped for tonight's stream, but I am. I am hyped, and you'll find out why. So if you want to contribute, you can hit that support button on Odyssey and send a tip. And if you send a tip, I'll read it out and you can get involved in the discourse. Or you can go to Entropy and there you can ask paid or non-paid questions. And let's face it, tonight it's Film Club, so we're going to accept it all. If you've got an opinion on this film, you know, please do hit us up with a question or a comment about whether you enjoyed it or not. Now, you will know one of our numbers down. It is, of course, St. Harrison. Unfortunately, he died at about 3 p.m. today. The sun got too much for him. He melted into a pool of white chocolate, and he's currently being hoovered up. So hopefully we can put him back in the fridge and he'll reconstitute into a solid block for next Film Club. But he's not here today. So I'm going to start by introducing the lovely Laura Towler. And I'm going to say, hello, Laura. Have you survived the heat wave? And if so, what kind of frost magic did you use to survive it? Did you enjoy this film? And what were your initial impressions?
What's up with you tonight? I think the heat's got to you. You've gone a bit mad.
No, I had one of those extra large Red Bulls and I had a long car journey as well because it was my father's birthday. So I have actually cooked myself in the car and I was drinking an extra large Red Bull at the time. And every time I've checked the news for anything to post on Telegram, all it's been about is how we're all going to die. And this isn't a joke, actually. You've triggered me now. This was actually the headline in the Daily Mail today. Britain goes into meltdown over 106 degree Fahrenheit, hottest day ever that is set to hit on Monday and Tuesday. One expert says thousands could die as Londoners are told don't travel at all unless it's essential. And the NHS sounds the alarm. The Londoners being told not to travel unless it's essential. That had nothing to do with the weather. That was just because London is a failed multiracial state and you probably get stabbed to death on the tube. Anyway, Laura, if you'd see fit to answer my questions. But if I am a bit overactive today, it is the Red Bull. So my apologies.
No, it's okay. Yeah, I'm good. I mean, I was going to say I'm too hot, but I didn't say it now. it's too hot. Catherine's struggling as well with the heat. We had to take all the clothes off and just lay her on top of a towel on the bed today just so she could cool down and fan her and try and get her a bit cooler. But yeah, we went to York for the day, had a potter around York, had an ice cream, did a bit of walking, went around some charity shops, bought some baby clothes. It was a good day. Are we jumping into the film straight away? Or are we just
Say, what were your initial impressions? And in a vague way, without ruining it or putting any spoilers in, did you enjoy the film?
It's all right. It is what it is, isn't it? It's a zombie film. You're never going to get some deep meaning in there. I think it's one of those films where what's on the screen is just, there's never anything more. There's never anything to sort of dig into. It's just you're watching the action on the screen. And that is the story, and that's it. So I thought it was all right. It's not really my genre. I don't really like action. I know it's a zombie or a horror, but it is action in it. It's fighting zombies. I think for a horror, it's it's all right. You know, usually horror movies have got really bad acting in and cheesy scripts, and I think this is pretty good. I do like Danny Boyle. You know, Trainspotting is one of my favourite films of all time. I like the music. I really like the music. It reminds me of The Last of Us, you know, the computer game. Have you played that? It reminds me of that.
I only play Nintendo games. I was going to make a really good joke there, but you've already told me off being hyperactive. So
I don't know how we're going to fill 2 hours talking about this film, because it's just a zombie film where the zombies come after him.
Oh, Laura.
Kill him.
I was going to say as well, that I think there are some big social critiques near the end.
Oh, Laura's basically, if Laura sees, and firstly, right, my joke was going to be, if you had some like autistic sort of fat, bespeckled, spotted slob on this stream, he'd be like screaming at you, you know, going, they're not zombies, they're infected. Zombies are when people get raised from the dead and move slowly. These are infected with a disease called rage. They're not technically zombies. Yeah,
in this zombie month.
It is zombie month. Look, these are more or less zombies. These are more or less zombies. But technically, when you watch the film, they're not actually zombies, are they? They're people infected.
All right. Well, it's not a zombie film then. I don't know what else. It was all right. I didn't hate it.
Would you be
it.
Giving it a higher score if it was an actual zombie film?
I would be giving it a higher score if it had something to keep me hooked or some, I don't know, just a good script or, I mean, it's all right. I hope people don't think I'm slagging it off that much, because it's all right. It's just, there was nothing there that made me think, wow, I want to go and watch that again, or wow, I can't wait to see what happens. But let's move over to Nativist, because he has a
he's not a woman, basically. Laura, when it comes to anything outside sort of films that a woman could enjoy, she sort of turtles and refuses to take it seriously. Well, you might have to draft Sam in for some opinions.
My favourite film is The Godfather. That's not a woman.
Yeah, that's a good point. Where's Sam? Is he with Catherine?
Yeah,
yes. Yes. Right, Nativist, come on, man. Did you melt at the weekend? And if you didn't and you're still alive, what do you think of this film, and what are your initial impressions?
I've had a good weekend watching a bit of golf and sitting in the park watching the deer and squirrels today. That was nice. Third time of watching for me. The first time I watched it, I did really enjoy it. Second time I watched it, I was a bit distracted and I didn't really immerse myself, and I thought less of it. And third time of watching a few days ago, I put my proper headphones on, dark room, paid attention. I love the film again. It's obviously low budget, but you can get beyond that. I think particularly the first 20 minutes is very gripping. There are some unique scenes, especially as a Londoner, seeing Cillian Murphy walking through, you know, places in London that are very recognizable to me, and them just be completely empty, covered in rubbish, abandoned cars. It's well done. I mean, obviously you can sort of tell by the angle of the sunlight that this was done at, you know, 4 a.m. in the morning around Westminster and Horse Guards Parade. And probably at a weekend for the scene around the Bank of England. But there's a lot of suspense created, through wide angle shots from up in different viewing posts, like looking down on him. The music is quite unique and really adds to the atmosphere. And I do think the storyline does go somewhere. I did want to know what happened. I think there are some interesting social critiques towards the end. It's ultimately an affirmation of liberal values. I'm looking forward to discussing it in a bit more detail. I'm glad I like this film again.
Okay, thank you. And Nativist hits there with a really big point that we're going to discuss later, actually. This film made about 80, I think it was about 84 million at the box office of a budget of just 8 million. So it's a very low budget film, and it was very profitable. In fact, it was one of the most profitable films during the year it was released. But before we get into all that, I'm going to give my opinion on this. Now, you guys have been asking for a zombie film for ages, and I was happy to give you a zombie film. But when you kept voting for 28 Days Later, and when 28 Days Later kept coming up as the film you guys wanted to see, I was a little bit sort of, ugh, gosh. Because I remember watching this not long after it came out. And I remember not liking it. I remember thinking, oh, God. And I found it. I just remember not liking it. And I had bits and pieces of memories about the film. Now, interestingly, zombie films are always made in two halves. They're what I call films of two halves. Most films are meant to have three acts, but zombie films are really films that can be split down quite easily into two parts. The first part is the outbreak. It's sort of how things went wrong, how the world got to be the way it was. And the second part is what I call the hero's journey, which usually focuses then more directly on a group of survivors who are battling to escape the aftermath, or to whether that be the immediate aftermath, or in this case, 28 days later. And bear that in mind, it's a film of two halves. Now, I sat down to watch this, and I actually watched it in two halves, interestingly enough. I think I watched about 45 minutes in my first viewing. Then I was pulled away to do something else. And that first 45 minutes, I've got to say, I absolutely loved it. I loved it. I was thinking, this is brilliant. The cinematography was amazing. The storytelling was brilliant. The use of real world locations was fantastic. The music, as Laura said, just incredible. I just thought it was a very, very well put together film, especially considering the budget, the camera angles, the way it appears that you're watching the action unfold through CCTV, the way the outbreak happened, the sense of sort of foreboding and isolation from the main character, who is lost in what should be one of the most teeming metropolises in the whole world, but instead he's wandering through the streets scared and lost, not knowing what happened. And I also love the way it tells the story. It doesn't tell the story as it happens, but it tells the story because the primary protagonist is basically piecing it all together. And I really liked all that. And I went away from viewing the first half thinking, gosh, I don't know why I didn't like this film the first time. Then I thought, did I misinterpret it? Was I not watching it correctly? Was I watching it with somebody who was doing my head in? So it sort of coloured my view of that film. Because sometimes you listen to an album with somebody, or it's a special album that you share with somebody. You can't really listen to it again after you fall out with that person. Or you go to the cinema and you have like a favourite film with somebody. Again, you fall out with them and it colours your memories of that thing. I thought, why didn't I like this? So I went out into my day thinking, God, this is a good film. And actually thinking about how impressed I was by this low-budget British zombie film that made this huge profit, thinking, I understand now why people liked it. And I was actually looking forward to watching the second half. And then I sat down and I watched the second half. And oh my gosh, the second half has got to be one of the most irritating, jumbled, anti-white, nonsensical load of rubbish I've ever seen. And the second half is not only nonsensical, but it's filled with so many stupid moments that it not only takes you out of the film and makes you think, who actually made the second half of the film? Because it doesn't seem to be the people who made the first half. The people who made the second half, it's like there's a whole new team brought in. In fact, you could say the first half was made by talented filmmakers. The second half was made by the same crew after they came in, became infected with some zombifying disease. Maybe the zombifying disease is called liberalism. And yeah, there's continuity issues. There are bits that don't make sense. The stuff that happens later down the line that sort of spits all over, or is not, you know, has poor continuity with things that happened earlier. And I remembered why I didn't like this film. So I'll say this, I'm not going to give my final score already, but I will say this, it is a film of two halves. And if you watch the first half of this film, turn it off at about the hour mark, turn it off when they make the escape from London. Once they get out of the London, once they've done the supermarket bit, once they're driving up the road towards Manchester, turn the film off and just say they escaped. and you'll have just seen a fantastic short zombie film. Don't watch the second half. It is complete and utter pants. Now, saying all that, I'm going to ask everyone's opinions on this. Obviously, it was a film of two halves. And I think Laura said something really interesting. What did you think to the world building in this film? And by world building, I mean sort of the establishing shots, the fact that Cillian Murphy woke up in the hospital. Because I did think the first half of how they introduced the plague to the world was really, really good. And I was absolutely gripped. Now, Laura, I'm thinking I'm going to get some pushback from you here. So go ahead and tell me I'm wrong.
No, I thought that was good. I remember it being a big thing when it came out. Everyone were talking about it and everyone was like, oh, how did they manage to get London empty? Obviously, they did it like really early in the morning. But I thought that was good. I liked, you know, him waking up and wandering around London and there's like money everywhere and he's picking it up. And of course, it's worthless now. It's eerily silent. I like the music, the shots. It looks good. It's just that was such a short part of the film. After that, because I've seen the film before, you see, I saw it quite a few years ago, so I knew it happened. And watching it again today, I was a bit like, all right, yeah, that bit looks cool. Now I need to watch the rest of the film. And I was just a bit meh. I mean,
You watched it during the daytime again, Laura. I told you, you have to watch these films at night.
I have a baby and I can't make too much noise because if I leave her, she cries. And yeah, it's difficult at the minute. But the actress that played the kid was such a bad actress. It was like really, really off-putting. Every time she opened her mouth, I was just like, oh, how did you get this job? I don't know if she's done
what else. I agree with you there. She was truly awful and her career never went anywhere.
Oh, well, there you go then. The black woman irritated me, everything she did.
Whoa, Laura, we've not got onto her yet. There's a whole this film review is going to be like 3 hours long. There's an extra hour tacked on to the end called Why the Black Woman is the Most Irritating Character to Ever Be in a Film Ever.
Shall I leave that for later on then?
Ever. I should really tell you the plan of these things, but yeah, there's a whole section on her because I
find her in a little bit.
I told you about this on the car when I was in the car earlier when I rang you. I actually said how irritating I found this woman. But yeah,
you can tell you two live in Yorkshire away from diversity. You know, I'm used to Jamaican and African.
Oh no. Nativist, you've got to say. I mean, we're breaking into this. It's happening, isn't it? But right, let's just do this now, and then we'll get back to what nativists thought about the beginning. I mean, just briefly, we'll give this woman her own whole section. But I've got to say, you know, I don't swear on streams very often, but I think the best way to describe this woman was complete and utter gobshite. I mean, she was terrible, She's short with people. She's rough, she's standoffish, she's know-it-all, she's superwoman. She's almost like every single irritating cliche that could be about sort of an irritating, overbearing, entitled female. And she happens to be black. I mean, to be fair, if a white woman delivered all those lines and behaved in that way, I think I'd be just as irritated, to be fair. But she was a character that I actually hated. And if I was in that scenario, I would just wait till she fell to sleep and I'd put the bag of food over my shoulder and I'd be gone. I'd take my chances on my own rather than having to contemplate a lifetime wandering around, you know, a desolate Britain, listening to her chirping in my ear every 5 seconds and bossing me about. She is awful.
But you actually used the word that I was going to use, and that was cliche. I just felt like it was such a cliche character. But then do you know the bits where she's like in the supermarket and she's laughing and joking with the kid? She like did this 180 of a character, and I just felt like it was so forced and it were really, really false. And obviously they're trying to build up like her relationship with the kid because she cares about the kid for what happens in the future. But it was like a character just changed, and I don't know why it suddenly changed for this kid. And I thought it was really forced. I just found it really, really, really annoying.
The supermarket scene is vastly different from those that precede it. I mean, the music changes and you know they're not in danger at that point. It's a very uplifting scene and, you know, they feel safe at that moment. But yeah,
she even bosses them about in the supermarket scene. She even, they're all having fun, and she even sort of barks orders at the men, saying, nothing. What did she say? Don't pick up anything that isn't in a can or something like that. And you're just like,
how can you have fun when you've just killed your mate and when you've just found out that your parents are dead? That's why.
She was terrible. She was terrible. I've got to say, I found her so irritating. She was one of the reasons when I originally watched the film, but I remember hating it because I just found her sort of the irritating wish. And I don't necessarily want a woman to be a damsel in distress. I didn't necessarily want her to be crying.
Nativist
isn't satisfied unless the woman's crying. That's,
I can't stand.
There's a quote for his future wife. So come on then, Nativist. What do you think to the opening? We'll go back to this irritating one. What do you think to the opening of the film, the first half?
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, especially the first 20 minutes. Is the first scene the lab scene? You know, you got the...
Yeah, we'll talk about the lab scene in a second because I think that's quite important.
You've got the chimp sort of chained to the, or sort of operating table type thing. And he's watching violence on TV, A Clockwork Orange. It's like that scene from A Clockwork Orange, but with a chimp. And then you've basically got, you know, what the equivalent of Antifa turning up to, to set all the chimps free. And then you've got quivering David Schneider as a scientist, or you don't know what you're doing. It's great. There's a lot of tension built up in that scene. You know, you've got like camera angles behind sort of going very close to the chimps, stuck in their glass boxes. The camera goes behind these sort of different boxes. You've got tension between the group, the sort of animal rights Antifa lot versus the scientist and him trying to escape. And, you know, it's gripping right from the start.
One thing about the lab scene, though, did anyone else think the lab didn't really look like a lab?
Yeah, but, you know, they're experimenting I've seen
the inside of animal testing labs. You've seen it on the news, you see shots of it, you've seen people who've broken into these places and taken pictures. And this was just like a big wet warehouse with like water all over the floor and glass cages on big concrete, like upturned, you know, like sort of letter N's almost, sort of big upturned sort of rectangles. And I did think that did look almost like comically low. Like the film, I think they do great things with the budget, but I did think that opening section was almost comically low budget.
Well, I'm impressed they got the chimps available for that sort of filming. You know, in 2000 or, you know, when it was mainly filmed, I wouldn't expect them to even be able to get away with, you know, putting chimps in boxes and tying them to tables and stuff. I don't hate the opening. And I think, you know, it feels like some sort of illegal lab rather than something official. So you could account for it looking a bit unprofessional. But yeah, do you want me to talk about the scenes thereafter?
Take it where you want. I wanted to do sort of, as it is such a film of two halves, let's talk about the first half, the things we like, the things we didn't. Then we'll talk about the second. Because I do think all zombie films, you know, to a large degree, work on that it is a film of two halves kind of thing, where you watch the first half and it's the collapse. Then you watch the second half and it's very much the, you know, survivor's story. And sometimes, you know, depending on what particular film you've got or what particular film you're watching, one half might be better than the other. And I think in this case, you know, I think there is a clear this was the better half. So I do let's just discuss the first half and then we'll move on. But you can also comment on the female lead, because both myself and Laura have said we found her quite irritating. When we say quite irritating, we both found her extremely obnoxious
And that level of obnoxiousness sort of put me off her completely as a character. And I think Laura feels the same. So comment on any of that stuff you want, and then we'll get Laura's take on the lab scene at the beginning.
I mean, after the lab scene, you do get this collapse moment where they play what is real footage of various riots and police trying to, you know, stamp down on them from probably recent years in the 90s, as it was then. And it's all wrapped up very quickly. You know, I can't really remember now, but it's probably about 2 minutes of these film clips and army and, you know, helicopters and evacuations and news headlines and this kind of thing. And then it's done. The collapse is done. And then you're introduced to Killian waking up from a coma in the hospital, or as his character's name is Jim. But I think it was a big start for Killian Murphy's career. And probably Christopher Eccleston's as well. Fantastic performance from him, but yeah, we'll discuss him later. As you say, as I mentioned in the introduction, it reminded me of The Thing. You know, Killian walking around scenes of empty London. You get these scenes of just one man in an expanse in emptiness, juxtaposed to answers a zombie. He's talking to the zombie priest. It's all very enclosed, and often there are these there's this polarity between wide open space and feeling alone, and tight spaces where they're being pursued by the zombies. And in the same way as that works in The Thing, it works for this film. I'm not really sure why they sort of blew up the petrol station, but you know, it was kind of exciting. And then we're introduced to the character that you two despise. I mean, I'm used to these sorts of people. You know, London's full of them. You know, she's a survivor. She's an alpha female. She's rude. She's very typical of her tribe, shall we say? You know, I'm used to it. I wasn't particularly irritated. She's unlikable, but whatever, is what it is. And in a scenario like societal breakdown, you could sort of forgive that kind of person. And I think it works. And, you know, she does show a softer side in romance and developing their relationship with Hannah after they escaped to the outpost. But yeah, you're right about it being a film of two halves. And yeah, the first half is fantastic. And, you know, an exhibition in low budget creative cinematography and good music selection, and, you know, giving actors at the start of their career a chance. So many films I like, they have all the A-listers from the start of their career. You know, it's good directing, it's good selection of the cast, and they probably weren't paid very much. And then, you know, once an actor makes it, they just go on this Hollywood merry-go-round of just, you know, it's the same people in the same films all the time. And I like to see those low-budget films where someone gets their break, and it's, you know, it demonstrates the skill of the director and the casting. But yeah, I'll let Laura say what she thinks.
Well, Laura asked me a very cheeky question earlier on, didn't you, Laura?
I thought we weren't going to talk about it on the stream.
Well, somebody's already mentioned it in the chat. And also, shout out to Chief Moody in the chat. He said, I recommend a film called REC, R-E-C. It's a Spanish found footage horror film from 2007-2008. He's actually correct. It's a really good film. So shout out to Chief Moody there. Laura, so obviously you've talked about you. So I think we're all kind of united here saying that we really enjoy the first half of the film. We really enjoyed the first half. We really enjoyed the establishing shots. We really enjoyed the music. But Laura, it is now your turn to say who is the most irritating character in this film, which is obvious, but give your opinion.
Yes, I don't really have anything else to add about her, but I just found the black woman really annoying. From when she didn't she like pull her helmet off at the start, and it was like, oh, it's a black woman, here we go, and then she would just it was just so cliche, the sassy, like, I don't listen to anyone and I'm in charge here. And then I don't know, when she flipped like and started being all nice, I just thought it were really forced and fake, and the character were just so 2D. She just annoyed me. I'd avoid someone like that in real life.
Yeah, I got to say, during this film, because I like character arcs, but I like character arcs to take place either realistically or over a longer period. And I'll give you two great character arcs. There's the character arc of what was once the primary antagonist in Dragon Ball Z, a character called Vegeta. And his character arc over the some 460 episodes was amazing. And equally, Carol from The Walking Dead. That's a character arc, but kind of in the opposite direction. So one of these characters mellows, the other hardens. But that takes place over time, and it's very gradual, and you enjoy their character arc, and you enjoy the fact that during their character arcs, they actually question the changes themselves. But I thought there was two really jarring, not really character arcs, but almost like character flips in this film. Firstly, Cillian Murphy, and we'll talk about the second half in a minute, goes from being sort of a guy who's spent 4 weeks in a coma, would have probably woken up with wasted muscles, you know, serious dehydration, brain fog, and then major trauma to find out he's a family dead, to being a guy who ends up with a body count that's greater than John Rambo's from the first Rambo film. And then you have this black woman who starts off as being this really irritating, sassy, harsh, cold, horrid woman. And then she becomes this damsel in distress. And I find both of those character arcs to be really, really irritating. But Laura, you asked me a very pressing question. And for amusement's sake, I'm going to allow you to ask it now.
Okay. I asked Mark earlier if he was the last man on Earth and there was one other person and it was a black woman, would he go there in order to continue the human race?
And I said, highly unlikely, but if it was this particular woman, I wouldn't care what colour she was. As I said, the food bag would have been over my shoulder and I'd have been out there on the first night. She was such an irritating character. Being around her would just be too intensely irritating to cope with. And I found it actually really, really, I found her so, so irritating that fundamentally she actually made me partially, you know, she was the fly in the ointment of the first half of this film, a constant irritant throughout the film. And at the end, almost a good reason not to watch this film. That's how much I disliked her character. I said that, and that isn't just based on any woman could have played that character. This is not, I don't think she was acting sort of stereotypically black. I think she was acting stereotypically.
Oh, she was. She was. No, they
don't
like
you
that.
Find? No, but don't you find, this is just to throw a curveball here to your nativist. Don't you find that women in films today, regardless of colour, are written in an obnoxious and irritating and grating fashion? Like, if you were,
oh yeah, they definitely upped alpha females in particularly the last 10 years. It never used to be the case. I mean, if you compare the latest James Bond film to 1960s James Bond, compare the characters of the women in there, and then, you know, they see how cultural change is being pushed through cinema.
That's it. For me, this isn't just a racial issue, because I really, really can't stand Charlize Theron in Mad Max Fury Road. She just irritated the hell out of me throughout that entire film. Just really, really did my nut in. And I just can't find that thing. I can't find women like that attractive. I can't find them to be people that I would actually want to be in their company or spend time with. Now, that's the first half of the film. So let's go on to the second half of the film. Now, as I said, I think all of us, even the mighty Laura, even the mega critical mighty Laura, said the first half of the film had, at the very least, major redeeming qualities. And me and Nativist obviously gave it overwhelming thumbs up. But let's go on to the second half, because I hate the the second half of this film. So much so, it almost feels as if it was made by a different team of filmmakers, because there are just continuity errors and problems in the film that are so glaring and so ridiculous that they actually make you wonder how the second half of the film got made. And I'll expand on that if people want me to go through them. But Laura, so they escape to Manchester, and I'll fill the audience in. They escape to Manchester, and they get to Manchester, and they get to a checkpoint. And initially they think the checkpoint's abandoned. The dad of the girl starts going, no, and having a paddy. And there's a dead body up on a tower. How a dead infected body got up there, no one knows. Very unlikely. The infected probably wouldn't be up high like that. They're probably running around down low, but there's a dead infected body up there. Bit of blood drips from the body, lands in the dad's eyes. He gets infected. They all think they're going to get killed. Two soldiers jump up, kill the infected dad with extreme precision, take the group to this big country mansion that these last surviving garrison of soldiers have sort of, turned into a fortress. And then it soon transpires that the real enemy of this film, the real bad guy, it's not zombies. It's not infected, rage-filled monsters. The real enemy of this film is nasty, horrible, rapey men. Nasty, horrible, rapey men that want to rape an underage white girl and the irritating black woman. And at this point, the film morphs from being something thoroughly enjoyable to being the stupidest, most irritating film imaginable. And what makes it worse is it ruins the whole film. It colours the film so much for me. I actually couldn't stand this second half. And I'm going to talk about some of the problems with the second half immediately. Like, one of the problems with this is everything falls to pieces. People's characters completely flip. White guy Jim goes from being, well, I've only been awake for 3 days, probably have severe muscle atrophy, but now I'm John Rambo, and he's killing trained soldiers with his bare hands, diving through windows. And he's doing it all bare-chested in the pouring rain, covered in his enemy's blood. He really does transform into sort of a skinny, like, beta male version of Rambo. But as I said, shockingly, he has a higher kill count in this film than John Rambo does in Rambo First Blood. That is not a joke. That is not a joke. In fact, he has a higher kill count in this film than Schwarzenegger does in some, Schwarzenegger films. Shocking. The black woman becomes a damsel in distress who just doesn't know how to deal with anything and becomes like a sex object, even though she's clearly not very attractive. And the worst bit about it is the soldiers who initially emerge from this dense undergrowth by the side of the M62, shouldering their rifles and firing shots with absolute precision as if they were, the SAS themselves. Then, after about 20 minutes, they descend into guys who look like they've never shot a gun before. They can't hold their rifle. They're firing wildly from the hip. They can't form formations. They've got no discipline. The whole thing falls to pieces. Laura, am I being too harsh? Or have I understated the problem with the second half of this film?
No, I think I think you're correct. Although I don't rate the first half as much as you guys did. It wasn't like it got halfway through and I'm like, oh, this has gone downhill. To be honest, I couldn't be arsed with it from the start. But is it bad that like all of the people in that house reminded me of Vinnie Sullivan with the accent? They all had the same accent.
You're not saying that Vinny's stupid, because obviously he's not. This is not having a go at Vinnie Sullivan, but
no,
they do
it's
all
the
have.
Accent.
Yeah, it's the accent. It's not Vinny's a Vinny's not stupid in the slightest. And
the accent. It's they all had like the London accent, didn't they? They're like, I can't do it. Like you said,
yeah. So they're meant to be like these troops from Manchester, but they all have. They don't sound like they're a northern garrison, put it like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they all have like Cockney sort of, I don't know where Vinny's from. Is he from the East End or what? But they all talk like that as well. Yeah, so they all reminded me of him. And like you said, the black woman suddenly became really just weak, didn't she? like crying and feeble. And to be honest, I didn't mind Cillian Murphy turning badass because I think he, as an actor, is cool enough to do that. Obviously, he physically wouldn't have been able to do that because, like you say, he'd been in a coma and he wasn't trained. And didn't he say that he was a courier or something? That was his job.
Yeah, he goes from bike courier to sort of top-tier SAS operator, you know, with so many skulls on his uniform for his confirmed kills. He needs an extra sleeve sewing on there. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. I didn't mind him doing that because I think he's cool enough to... I mean, he's Scarecrow in Batman. I think he's cool enough to do it. So that didn't bother me that much. But yeah, it was just a bit... And obviously these people want to, like, these soldiers want to fight and continue and, like, have another generation of people. And I just feel like, I mean, what were the three main people going to do? Just run away and be like, and die? I think I maybe sided with the soldiers a little bit. I don't know if what you two think. I quite like the major guy as well. I quite liked him. I thought he was a good character, and I thought he
Christopher Eccleston
well.
Did a good performance. The only good
he was a great guy. He was an all around great guy.
Yeah, that's it. Really, I quite liked him, and I did agree with quite a bit of what they were saying. Yeah.
Okay, Nativist, what did you think of the second half? Were you as irritated by it as I was?
Yeah, I mean, it is a bit clownish at times. And I do agree, it sort of comes off as like the first half was like a serious horror film. And then, like many of these series, the libtards like take over the plot and just ruin it in the second half. That's kind of like what it feels like. But yeah, I was, you know, you sort of introduced to the second half, shall we say, through what's Hannah's dad's name? Is it Frank? He gets infected. You know, he becomes aware of his own infection. He pushes his daughter away to save her, and then he's, you know, executed on the spot by the soldiers. And then we're introduced to this very primitive structure, you know, which is Major West and his band of squaddies. And, you know, whenever the squaddies that I've met, I mean, a lot of them were quite true to form in you know, they are, as the film depicted them, they're very laddish, it's 20... wall-to-wall banter and, you know, maybe some incompetence on the cooking side. And it's a bit jovial, a bit bantery to start with. And you can sort of get behind it that they're all, you know, kept together by Major West being experienced, intelligent, well-spoken. He's very polite to the guests. I mean, you know, the squaddies are... driving round the taxi of, you know, Frank, and Hannah is just quiet as she has to put up with them mucking around with her recently zombified father's car. But nonetheless, you feel that it's a stable structure. It's a primitive command structure, but, you know. And then as it continues, it's revealed that actually the name of the game is repopulating the world after, you know, societal collapse. And, you know, I can get behind Major West's way of thinking on this. It is an imperative to reproduce oneself and continue humanity. And yeah, to answer Laura's question from earlier, if you had the responsibility of continuing humanity or letting humanity die out when humanity has potentially 5 billion more years in the solar system before the sun swallows the earth or whatever, you know, that's a responsibility. We all have a responsibility to reproduce. Certainly if you're, you know, eugenically selected, shall we say. Anyway, the squaddies are very, you know, they're very harsh about what the situation's going to be. You know, it is disgusting and rapey when it needn't be in that scenario. It could have been, you know, a gradual realization that the women would be expected to reproduce when the time comes or whatever. You know, Hannah is very young. I mean, the film was released when she was 16, I believe, but she does look like she's 13 in the film. But the key point for me that sort of defines Jim's character arc is when he sort of stands up for liberal values and a woman's right them and basically take him to be executed. And when he wriggles out of that situation, he's left on his back after jumping over a wall, and he looks up and he sees a plane. Now, this was a profound point of the film for me, because this demonstrates that there is liberalism outside. And if he gets outside of this situation, he can return to liberal values rather than responsibility of continuing humanity in this primitive structure that they found themselves in. After that point, he becomes obsessed with killing all the rapey squaddies and rescuing the women and their right to choose, right? And then it does go into Clown World, where, you know, he's like a skinny bike courier, you know, probably an underachiever in life, and he becomes, you know, this superhero, James Bond-esque. You know, he just casually lets out the chained zombie, uses him as leverage to create panic in the troops. You know, he's everywhere. He's controlling the situation from outside the windows. And then he rescues the girls and executes Major West at the end. I mean, it is very clownish. And I just at the end of it, I just felt like, well, you know, that's another win for liberalism and feminism and, you know, all these kind of values in a scenario which it would be completely unreasonable to, you know, pursue that line of their morality. So I don't know if you two picked up on that moment where he sees the plane in the sky and realizes there's liberalism outside, or, you know, an outside humanity, so he can escape from this primitive situation.
Well, I thought it was kind of a strange setup, really. And I'll explain why. This is what I didn't like about. Now, Cillian Murphy's been asleep for 4 weeks, and it's taken, since he's woken up, it's taken him about a week to get to Manchester. So 5 weeks out after the outbreak, you've got this holdout of soldiers in this house, and they've taken three people on board with them, two women and a man, or actually a woman, a girl and a man. And Somehow, in just 5 weeks of civilization going downhill, these guys, their number one concern is we need to find some women, force ourselves upon them, and start churning out babies. Now, I could understand that. Maybe. I could maybe be more sort of amenable to that thought process if it was kind of like 28 months later. If they'd been stuck in that house for 28 months, maybe 28 weeks, maybe it was, you know, a year or so, they were stuck there and they'd heard from no one, and these were the first two. But it's not even been 2 months. It's just been over a month, and they've almost gone completely mad. And when I say it's just been over a month since the outbreak, it won't have even been a month since they probably last saw a female or last heard from a female, because it took a good couple of weeks, maybe even 3 weeks, for everything to completely grind to a halt. So what you're probably saying here is within 2 to 3 weeks, a faction of the British Army had lost complete discipline, gone completely insane, and decided to concoct a plot somewhere in line with the plot of The Hills Have Eyes. So they were basically going to capture women to forcibly impregnate them to replenish their numbers after 3 weeks. I just found that absolutely ludicrous. And I thought what went from being quite a good sort of zombie slash infected horror flick to being sort of this big sort of attack almost on the patriarchy that, you know, if society goes to hell, men in power will be unleashed. You know, liberalism keeps men in power in check. But the minute there isn't liberalism, the minute you get back to a point where, you know, people have to actually fight for survival, men will be the real unchecked menace of the world. And I thought that as a theme was ever present in that second part of the film. And as I said, there was
something. Can I interrupt quickly, please?
Yeah, sure.
That is kind of explained by Major West finding one of his soldiers to be suicidal. I do think it is a reasonable excuse that in that situation you would at least make an attempt to give the, you know, hope of a future to the soldiers. So I do. I agree with your point.
If you look, the last time they saw a woman or other people who had contact with the outside world would have probably been 2 or 3 weeks ago. If in 2 or 3 weeks you're a complete gibbering wreck and you're putting your rifle in your mouth, you're probably not really cut out to be a soldier, and you probably aren't going to make it through anyway. And I know what the British Army contingency is for people who show any form of suicide. It's actually to disarm them and to cut them off from all of the soldiers and basically get them away from people. And I just thought the whole thing at that point was so desperate. The film was so desperate to prove this kind of, well, men are the real problem, aren't they? Aha! You know, you thought the monsters were the zombies. Oh, ho, ho, definitely not. The real monsters are the men. And I thought the film was so desperate to prove that, that it basically fell on its own sword. And there's so many silly bits as well. So when Brendan Gleeson plays the girl's father, the taxi driver, and when he's killed by the two soldiers, one soldier, why the soldiers didn't shout, "Hey, we're here," because they didn't. The soldiers didn't shout, "Hey, we're here." They just hid and let one of them get infected and let them all get crazy. Well, that just madness. But anyway, the soldiers are hiding. One's up on a gantry and one's in the bushes. And they don't say, hey, you know, we're here. They wait for one of them to get infected. And then two of them jump up with gas masks, all the gear on. They look like they're troops ready for warfare in a hazardous, after some kind of chemical or biological attack. They shoot Brendan Gleeson's character dead with extreme precision. And you're thinking, these guys are really, really serious. And then they become kind of like the sexually starved rape squad. But they can't then use their weapons either. The soldiers are all painted to be absolute abject idiots. They can't do anything for themselves. One of them's suicidal because he's not spoken to a bird for 2 weeks. Well, you know, go figure. What would you do? You know, that's generally the norm for soldiers, especially ones stationed abroad. But then none of them can fire their weapons. These guys who are crack commandos at the checkpoint, every time they pick up a rifle, they're firing it from the hip. It's just ludicrous. And I think it's almost as if, I don't know if this happened, but it almost feels like somebody from the studio came in and said to the guys, you know what, we've got to have some woke anti-male message in this film, and took everything in the first half away and injected all this crap into the second half, thus ruining the film. And the thing that really annoyed me is Jim and the woman could have had a character arc. Jim could have softened her and she could have hardened him. And by the end of the film, they both have learned something. But it wasn't that they just had a bit of a character arc. They just had a complete role reversal. And I think that role reversal was to suit this kind of liberal anti-male agenda pushed by the second half of the film. What do you think to this, Laura? You've been a bit quiet. What do you think to these criticisms? Are they relatively on the mark?
Yeah, I definitely think that it's like pro-liberalism and anti-authority in the second half. We're just used to it now, aren't we? It's pro-feminism as well and pro-choice maybe. rather than an individualism rather than collectivism. It's all of those messages. I'm not really sure what else to add about it other than what you guys have said, but one thing that we do need to talk about, which is related to this bit, is we're just chatting to Helentian in the chat, and he was saying that obviously there was there were people in other areas, and the soldiers and the major knew about it. Is that right? I don't know if I missed that bit. Did the major know about that? That there were people alive?
Of course he did. There was constantly flyovers of Britain by other nations' military. That's how they got found at the end. And this is the other thing that really shocked me with their descent into madness, that they all decided they had to like become part of this sort of rapey cult of men who couldn't fire their rifles anymore, is that they would have known there was other survivors. I mean, after 5 weeks, there may have been the majority of Britons would have been infected and it would be a hellscape. But I think there'd still be quite a lot of the population holding out, especially in rural areas. And it would be unthinkable that people who'd been manning a military checkpoint hadn't seen the flyovers by other nations' military. You know, I think it was marked as a Norwegian plane that discovered the survivors at the end?
Meant to be Finnish.
Finnish, yeah. So those planes would have been doing flyovers constantly. And I just, as I said, maybe people would have ended up being that crazy years afterwards. But I can't think that 2 to 3 weeks after last, you know, speaking to a woman or, you know, knowing that there was hope, you would have so quickly abandoned hope, especially not trained soldiers, and just become absolute dirtbags. I think that was really hammering home a point that men are, you know, that men are bad.
So why were he going to kill himself if he knew about the life?
The plot needed him to. The plot needed him to.
Wouldn't it have been better that the major knew about it, but he was hiding it from his soldiers?
But that's what I'm saying. None of it makes sense. It's almost like they had to. This film had a great start. I know, Laura, you don't think it's as great as me and nativist thing, but it's almost like they had to put this liberal, anti-male message, or you know, anti-military message, or message against the patriarchy in it so much that to shoehorn that message in, they almost, for me, it ruined the whole film, and it left so many awkward and unanswerable questions that it was just ruined for me. So you've got all these things. Firstly, the guys could use their rifles. Then they couldn't. Why are they broken down to complete despair within 3 weeks of society, you know, looking like it was in almost an irredeemable mess? Why did they go to despair when there'd been multiple flyovers by aircraft from, you know, other developed Western nations? If you're in the military, you would know that there would be submarines, there would be naval vessels which are constantly situated offshore that absolutely would be safe. You would also know that there would be special forces surrounding the Prime Minister, the Queen, etc. Somebody at the level of being a major, such as Christopher Eccleston's character, he would know that there would be contingencies for special forces and for dignitaries to be kept in bunkers. There's huge networks of bunkers in the UK left over from the Cold War, which would be instantly requisitioned in a period like this. You know, the infected would have no power against tanks and helicopters, etc. You know, military bases themselves probably wouldn't be overrun. And as I said, there would be people on oil rigs. There would be people who were out at sea when this infection broke out who could have got out to sea. There would be people on the Shetland Islands. You know, there's so many reasons why these guys wouldn't have acted so rashly after, as I said, 2 to 3 weeks. But I just think the film needed it to happen. So they were like, to hell with all of the world building, to hell with all of the logic we've built up. You know, the fact that there was a father and daughter still alive in central London, signalling people, listening to a wind-up radio. Yeah. Total cack. And I think sometimes, and I've got to say this, sometimes they prioritise their either their anti-white, their anti-male, their anti-family message to such a degree that
they force it into a film, almost like forcing a wedge into a small gap. If you force it in hard enough and fast enough, it'll just cause the gap to open, and whatever object that gap's in just shatters apart. And I think this film was just shattered by this very strange and ill-fitting message, which had no place in the film, but was that was just hammered into it. And if there had been another hour of this film when they got to Manchester, of them saying, well, there's no one at the barricade, we have to get to, you know, I don't know, an island off the coast of Scotland, or we have to get to this place, or, you know, Brendan Gleeson being like, when I was a kid, I was brought up on the Isle of, you know, whatever, the Isle of McTaffy, and we have to get there because there's only one little, you know, it was abandoned after my family left, and I know it'll be safe. And there was a ferry port that took people, and they had, you know, they got to the ferry port and they got to the little island, and then they got, and there was more dramas along the way, and maybe somebody died. I think this could have been a really spectacular, very British and very good low budget film. I just felt it was ruined by all this sort of cack-handed message that just seemed to be forced into it and undid all of the good of the film.
God, Mark's such an optimist that even when 99% of Britain has been zombified, he's like, think about all these opportunities.
Yeah, but there is
submarines. And
it's that Red Bull, I think.
No, it's not. Can you imagine? Right, let's imagine, you know, let's imagine we are three survivors. We are three survivors. There's, you know, the zombie outbreak happened. We're all at a PA event, and only me, Laura, and Nativist escape. I wouldn't start eyeing you up to eat you or to, you know, sexually assault you. I'd be like, come on, guys, you know, there's got to be some hope here. Let's try and find a nice supermarket. Let's raid it and let's get to, you know, a farmhouse or a little island off the coast of Scotland or somewhere right out of the way. Let's fortify it. Let's put a big message in the field nearby saying survivors here or something like that. There'd be something you'd start thinking about. You know, you wouldn't. I just don't buy this now. It just ruined it for me. I mean, you know, I thought, well, this is great. You know, somebody said I'd be killing myself because there were no cheeseburgers left. But that would be a major downer. But I'm sure if we found a supermarket, you know, we could find the odd cheeseburger. I just find it, I don't know. I find it irritating, but I also find it insulting to the audience's intelligence. I find the sort of about face and all the things that they sort of forced into the second half actually insulting to our intelligence. And then they also had like one thing that was interesting about it, okay, is Christopher Eccleston had one good plan. He chained up an infected and said, look, we have to figure out how long it takes for an infected to starve to death, because if we can do that, we know how long we have to hold out here for the majority of the infected, you know, to pass away naturally. And I thought that was quite intelligent. That was about the only clever thing he said. But other than that, it was just absolute rubbish, just depressingly so, because it ruined the first half. And as I actually watched it in two halves this time, it made it much more of a stark, you know, contrast between those two halves. And the other thing that really annoyed me is if I was going to try and rescue my friends who were captured by the British military, I wouldn't let a zombie loose in there. That was the most cack-handed plan ever, because these things multiply at an alarming rate. They kill with great ferocity. That's the stupidest plan ever. Kill the lights and let a zombie loose. You're just as likely to get your friends killed as you are to kill all the people you don't like. That's not a, you know, unleashing the zombie. The zombie wasn't like, right, I'm doing a deal with you. I'm only going to kill the military guys. As far as Cillian Murphy could have known, they would have burst into the bedroom and killed the young girl and his love interest as well. But no, we're going to unleash a zombie into the room, which is going to turn all the other military men into zombies too. And then you've got a whole other problem. It'd have been better off just bursting in with one of the rifles from one of the guys he killed and, you know, taking each soldier out with a bullet to the head. But his plan, even his plan was stupid. I'm getting all irritated just thinking about it.
Mark, do you reckon you'd be any good in a zombie outbreak?
Yeah, I would.
Why?
Because I'd just be, because if you're in that position, you've just got to be clinical and you've got to understand the lie of the land, there are several rules. You don't go anywhere on your own. Right, so let's look at the rules. What are the rules of 28 Days Later? Well, we're not just saying any zombies, because there's lots of different types of zombies, but we'll work on 28 Days Later. Would I survive? Well, here are the rules. Firstly, the zombies only come out at night. For some reason, they hate the light. It doesn't say why they hate the light, but they do. And when Cillian Murphy goes into the church and finds all the infected in there, they chase him out, but they don't come out into the light after him, do they? They only come at night. Okay, so that's the first rule. And that actually leaves you in a pretty good position, because it means you can travel at an optimum time. You can travel at an optimal time. Secondly, if they only come out at night and they don't like the sun, they have to hide somewhere through the day. So if you go out to a farmhouse in the middle of nowhere, first, it's unlikely that it's going to be full with zombies. And secondly, if it does have some zombies in, once you've killed them and got rid of them, it's unlikely that other zombies are going to make that long trek. Thirdly, these zombies are very, very fast moving. Okay. And they're attracted by noise or flashing lights in the evenings. So you have to bear that in mind. So number one, once you've got your farmhouse, you do what you need to do in the day, but you black out all the windows. The rules are very hard, they're very fast, and they're very easy to let you survive. And finally, the other rule is, if you are going and scavenging, if you are doing anything, you don't go anywhere at night, and you don't go anywhere on your own. You always go in two or more to cover each other's back, and you always have to stay frosty. And your number one thing, once you got your farmhouse or once you got your place out in the countryside, would be to get what? Canned goods, packaged goods, goods that were you added water to them, so like dried pasta, etc. You want bottled water, bottles of carbonated drinks. You'd want medical supplies. But there would be supermarkets, petrol stations, etc., where you could get those from. I think that zombie world would be pretty easy to survive. Why? Do you think I'd get, like, killed in the first 10 minutes or something? Am I that guy who gets dead in the first scene?
Yeah, you're the guy who gets chased by a zombie and runs upstairs instead of running outside.
Oh, God, that's the most scathing thing you've ever said to me. Do you think nativists would survive?
I think you and him would be similar, really.
We'd be dead right, straight away. Would Sam?
Oh, Sam would be brilliant. Sam's ready for it.
What do you mean he's ready?
I've got a gas mask. I've got a British military gas mask. I'm ready to go.
I reckon all the guys in PA would be pretty good at this. We've got a community. We do team building stuff together. We've found another strength for PA, haven't we?
Well, that's what I think. I think if this happened at a PA conference or camping weekend, I think we'd make it. And I also thought the zombies in this, or the infected, were pretty easy to defeat. You didn't need, like, in certain sort of zombie films, you do need, like, a straight bullet to the head. If you don't, you know, sever the spinal column or blow the brains out completely, it keeps coming. But in this, the infected were infected humans, so they still relied on their human physiognomy. They still relied on the heart pumping blood. They still relied on the lungs. They still relied on their organs functioning as a human would need them to function. And they required some kind of sustenance to keep going. So as Christopher Eccleston said, they wanted to see how long they'd starve to death. So I would say an infected would probably have they'd also probably die of exposure as well if it got too cold. You know, if they froze, it would kill them, because obviously that kills human beings if they freeze. So I do think if you survived, you know, if you went up somewhere to, like, Scotland, where it gets very cold in the winter, it was very unpopulated, I do think you could survive this. And I think if it was a PA group, I think PA would survive the zombie apocalypse. I'm going on record. Quote me.
I agree.
Yeah, given that it's got a 28-day starvation period, it's pretty easy, to be fair. You just got to, you know, find some food, really.
And have blackout blinds. Just black your windows out. And also, one thing that really bothered me about this is they all slept in the same room, but they all kind of slept at the same time. You would set it up in shifts. So you would have, say there was sort of six survivors, three would guard the house. You'd have two guarding the house through the day, two guarding the house at night, and you'd do it in shifts, and two going out scavenging. And obviously, if you had more survivors, you could split the shifts up in different ways. But I think a team of people could do that quite effectively. And you are dealing with just infected human beings. So if you reinforce doors and barricaded things, there's no way a human could punch through a double glazed window or through a reinforced door. They are still human. You know, they're not sort of super zombies. I think we could survive it. And I think Sam would be pretty good at it. I think Sam, give Sam a baseball bat with some barbed wire wrapped around it, he'd be surviving the zombie apocalypse, wouldn't he, Laura?
I should have just got Sam to guard the monkey lab so he could fight off Antifa and it would never have happened in the first place.
Yeah. Just out of interest, guys, you know the scientist, the guy who played the scientist at the beginning?
You mean David Schneider?
I can't take him seriously because he's the guy who played Tony Hares in I'm Alan Partridge. And I always see him as that. I couldn't see him as a scientist, but I did enjoy one thing I did enjoy that wasn't particularly politically correct was really the cause of the problem was sort of crusty, sort of anti-climate change, anti animal rights activists. I did find that quite amusing because usually they're sort of, seen as the good guys, but it was almost like Extinction Rebellion kicked this off. So I did quite like that bit of it. But look, we've been going for an hour and 11 minutes. We've only got one paid super chat so far. So if you want a super chat, you can. I've got a big surprise at the end for what film we're doing next month. We're not voting on what film it's going to be next month. Do you know what? You guys have been pestering me since we started Film Club to review this film. So I'm putting the hammer down and I've chosen what film we're doing next month, but I'll tell you at the end of this. But if you want to send a paid super chat, you can do, if you'd like to ask questions. But we do have some non-paid questions and one paid super chat, so we'll do them now. We've got the first the first and only paid super chat is from Malty Henrik, who gave $5. Thank you much. And he said, I'd like to encourage your film club to discuss popular World War II themed movies once in a while, like Das Boot, Inglourious Basterds, Downfall, etc. Hearing takes on these types of films from a nationalist perspective is always interesting and intriguing. Wishing you all a cozy night. Well, we did do a World War II one, didn't we? We did Schindler's List and we lambasted it. It was. So we're going to do the non-paid questions now. And as I said, if you want a super chat, there is still plenty of time. But we'll wrap it up if we get to the end of questions. There's no point going on for like 3 hours if there's nothing to talk about. And I think we've given this film a very good going over. And we've decided that we would survive the apocalypse. Although Laura was pretty shaky. She didn't think I'd be a leader for the apocalypse. That's very interesting. Maybe her and Sam are planning a leadership coup in terms of if we get a zombie apocalypse. Rouse Yourself from Slumber said, have you seen the 28 Days Later sequel, 28 Weeks Later? Yes, I have. Yes, it's okay, but it also suffers from some serious plot flaws. And apparently there was going to be a third called 28 Months Later, where the whole of Western Europe had been infected and the war had shifted to... the war had shifted to Russia and Russia was trying to control its land border against invading zombies. Obviously, that hasn't been made and is unlikely to be made now because of the Russophobic current political system. But Laura, have you seen 28 Weeks Later, the sequel, and did you like it?
I think I've seen it, but I can't remember it. So I can't really answer that, sorry. It was ages ago it came out, wasn't it?
It was, and there wasn't, the original cast weren't in it.
Yeah, I've not seen it. I mean, there are certain films where you just know the sequel's going to be garbage, so I tend to avoid those ones.
Yeah, and they said, I'm just reading here from possible sequel, they said... Alex Garland was asked what happened to 28 Months Later. He declared, "I'll answer that completely honestly. When we made 28 Days Later, the rights were frozen between a group of people who were no longer talking to each other. And so the film is never going to happen unless those people start talking to each other once again. And there's no script as far as I'm aware." So, yeah, I heard it was meant to be sort of Western Europe. But Western Europe was sort of infected, and sort of Eastern Europe, Russia, was sort of the last holdout. I will say, I thought it was kind of interesting because I did want to hear what happened to the survivors in 28 Weeks Later, and he didn't tell you that. And also, I thought there was a lot, from what I can remember, 28 Weeks Later, there was so much stupidity. The it was double the budget, 15 million, and it made 65 million. So they spent twice as much making it, and it made less at the box office. But I will say that the infected, here's the plot. During the original outbreak of the rage virus, Don, his wife Alison, four more survivors hide in a barricaded cottage in the outskirts of London. They hear a terrified boy pounding at the door. Alice lets him in. A few minutes later, they discover that the infected have followed the boy. The infected attack and kill almost all those survivors while Don, Alice, and the boy are chased upstairs. Don pleads with Alice to leave the boy, but she refuses. He abandons them as the infected break into their room by sweeping out the window. After watching his wife being dragged out of sight by the infected, he narrowly escapes on a boat piloted by Jacob, one of the remaining survivors, who falls into the water and is overcome by the infected. And then it says, after the infected begin to die, NATO forces take control of Britain. 28 weeks after the outbreak, an American force under the command of Brigadier General Stone brings in settlers. Among the new arrivals are Don and Alice's family. And then it all starts again. And I've got to say, the way the outbreak starts again is just ridiculous. And there's so many plot holes in the second. I didn't really think it was brilliant. We've got another question here from Rouse Your Slumber. A suggestion next month, a Nolan film. Maybe we might do a special Nolan film month. You're going to like what I've picked for next month because so many of you actually written to me. And when I say written to me, I mean actually messaged me or sent me emails saying, why don't you review this film? So we are going to review it. And we're going to review it in light of COVID and people's different theories about declining birth rates and depopulation. You get a prize in the chat if from that you've guessed what film we are reviewing next.
Is it Children of Men? Because I was going to...
Yes, it is! You win! We're reviewing Children of Men next, yeah.
Okay. I'm glad I didn't watch it last week then. I had it queued up and ended up falling asleep. So.
Yeah, we're going to watch Children of Men. You've ruined it, Nativist, but I said there'd be a prize, so you win the prize. Albion Forever said, 28 Weeks Later ends with the infected overrunning Paris. Yes, it does. Correct. Baron Brezik said, I know a trick against the heat. Cut a plastic bottle in half, fill it with water, freeze it down and place it in the room you're currently in. Plus, you can use the cold water to wash after it melts. Very good. Thank you. Baron Brezik also says, about the black woman, she's played by Naomi Harris, who also played Miss Moneypenny in the new James Bond film, the ones with Daniel Craig. I didn't know that.
Yeah, now that he says it, yeah. Is she as obnoxious in that? Not quite, but she is pretty annoying in Skyfall. I think that's where she sort of has her biggest role.
Yes. We've got another paid super chat from Igly. He said, how do you like 28 Weeks Later? And go, 3 Odyssey beans. Thank you, Igly. We've already said I didn't particularly like it, but a lot of people seem to do. P. Sutcliffe said, I agree with Mark. You don't see women in the kitchen today in movies. Also, it'd be more interesting stream if you viewed the Italian film Zombie, which was later retitled for the English audience Zombie Flesh Eaters. I added that bit. He said that ended on the Video Nasties list. Yeah, I wouldn't mind doing a Video Nasties special. Bill Atheling gave $5. Thank you so much, Bill. Very kind of you. And he said, great discussion, folks. I entirely agree. A good apocalyptic scenario ruined by wokeness. PA would survive. We would re-chad the world. We would. And, you know, one thing that you would do, or one thing I'd do, if I was in charge of PA and I survived the zombie outbreak, which Laura doesn't think I would, I'm really hurt by this, Laura. But one of my number one things would be, not only would we be looking for food, but we would be looking for survivors. I wouldn't want to see us all go feral and start eating each other or like preying on each other. I'd want us to go out there and look for survivors and build a bigger community. It'd be quite fantastic. But obviously anyone who had survived the outbreak and had like Antifa tattoos, they'd be heavily vetted and fed to the infected.
We've only got about 10 women in PA, so we need to put out the call sign for more women as well.
Well, that might be a problem. That might be a problem. Popcorn Power. But you know what? Let's just say
you were part of a group that was kind of heavily male centric in an apocalyptic situation. So let's say there was 20 women and 80 men. I still couldn't justify doing what those soldiers, as a white guy, I abhor rapists. I abhor sex offenders. I could never, ever, you know, regardless of the situation, force myself on a woman. That I think that's what sort of
how would you choose the mating pairs though? Would you do like a tournament of all the men?
No, you just whoever the women wanted to be with, they'd have to go with, wouldn't they? It'd just be like normal. You couldn't.
So you just give them like totally free choice when you're trying to repopulate humanity.
Well, if you'd have to. You couldn't. So what?
They make terrible choices though.
Well,
I think you'd have to manipulate the situation and have some kind of tournament.
People would have to be, I think it would have to be suggested to any single woman of childbearing age that now wasn't the time to be picky or have overly long courtships. But at the same time, you wouldn't be forcing people to do things they didn't want to. I think that would set the stage for a horrible society. What do you think, Laura?
Oh, I don't know. I think I'm somewhere in the middle of you two. I think, I don't think you could force it, but I think it has to be a little bit stricter and sort of encouraging.
A slight coercion in a eugenic direction.
Perhaps.
When not all the men are going to reproduce, you know, not even have a chance of, you know. I mean, women are quite good at selecting certain things, like, you know, genetic health, which is indicated by handsomeness. But, you know, if you're trying to repopulate humanity, you need to take into account other things like intelligence, for example, if you're going to build a complex society in future.
Do you know what? I think if it did go south, I don't know. I've just got faith in white people. I think whites would somehow make it through. I just think we would. Popcorn Power said, nativist, knowing that Mark wants to send Sam out with a barbed wire covered bat. That was obviously a reference to Negan from The Walking Dead, who's very cool. He said, when the infection spreads by blood, how long do you think Mark would last? Well, I've got to say, in 28 days later, initially they were all using sort of melee weapons, yet they all managed to survive infection. So how long do you think Sam would survive, or I would survive, wielding the bat nativist? I think you'd have to wear, you would actually have to go out masked up. I mean, this is actually a real threat to your health. This isn't sort of COVID. This isn't sort of a mild cough. This is actually, you know, the end of humanity. And, you know, technically you'd think by Boris Johnson and his team's response to COVID, that COVID was something in line with the 28 days later, but it wasn't. So how long do you think we'd survive with our baseball bat of doom, nativist?
What, in a scenario where you just go in for melee versus a big swarm of them?
Yeah.
Oh, 10 minutes in that scenario, but you're both intelligent guys. I'm sure you just barricade yourself in a cottage somewhere and just wait out wait for the zombies to starve.
I think the number one way for survival is isolation in this case. It's to get as far away from urban centres as possible and only return if you're desperate for scavenging in daylight hours. But I've already said that. It's survivable. Albion Forever said, the best part of 28 weeks later was seeing the hideous Canary Wharf complex getting glassed. Thank you, Albion Forever. That's very good of you to say that. And then number one cheeky, I'm not even reading your name. He said, do you think Big Sam could have saved the people with his epic rants on his Big Bertha microphone? Then he asked, when am I going to get out on the microphone or am I scared? And said, Big Sam is in the real 28 days later on the street trying to save our zombified people from the multicultural mind virus. Yes, Sam loves his megaphone. Do you know what? I'm going to address this actually, because I get quite a few people saying to me, people who troll me, troll me with two different things. If I always take the limelight wherever I go, they always say, oh, you always make it about yourself. But when I let other people do street activities and make the speeches and take the limelight, they always say, oh, Mark, why weren't you the one making the speech? Are you scared? Well, the answer is quite clearly that I do value people like Sam, Laura. I value multiple people in PA. And I actually do like to see new faces take to the streets and make a name for themselves. I don't want PA to be synonymous with Mark Collett and Laura Teller. I actually want PA to be an organization that fundamentally, fundamentally numerous people feel as if they can be a part of and play a leading role of. What do you think, Laura? Do you think it's good that we have lots of people stepping forward to making the big speeches and things like that?
Yeah, not everyone in PA has to do everything. We have a lot of difference between the regions. Like Yorkshire are obviously really, really good at street protests. Eastern are amazing at leafleting. Obviously, they won drama. Scotland are really good at like the really big stunts. Wales just consistently out doing stuff, whether it's drop a rock or banners or leafleting. And then we've got West Midlands who are really good at media. And I could go on and go through homeless outreach in the Northeast. The regions have different strengths and not everybody has to do everything. So just because Sam is doing megaphone protests, it doesn't mean that Mark has to do megaphone protests. That's the beauty of PA, because we're not a tentpole organisation where if Mark disappeared, everything would collapse and it would be over. We've got other people who can do things and continue without Mark's help or my help. So I do think it's a bit of a concern troll, because like you say, people will say to Mark, why are you doing this? Why don't you give somebody else a chance? Why are you speaking at the conference again? Ask somebody else to do it. But then if Mark doesn't do something, Mark, why didn't you do that? And I think it's just a concern troll. I've never heard a genuine person ask you why you're not doing that. But like I say, different people do different things and we have different strengths and weaknesses. I'm the deputy leader, but I couldn't do a street protest. And there's other things I can do that, you know, Sam can't do or Mark can't do. That's just how it works.
Well, I actually like giving speeches. It's something I enjoy doing. I enjoy speaking. I would happily give speeches at these street protests. And I would happily go out there and be at the front of things. But I do think it's important that there's more than just me as a figurehead for this organization. Because, God forbid, if something happened to me and I was the only person, it's like if, for example, Tommy Robinson. And we're not going to get into the goods and bads of Tommy Robinson. Apparently, he's done something very good this week. So credit where it's due. If he has actually successfully infiltrated Hope Not Hate and got the inside track on what Hope Not Hate are doing, and if he has actually genuinely got a list of informants, Hope Not Hate informants, and he's going to make them public, well, good for him and good for the movement as a whole. Well done, you know. But if Tommy Robinson did die, and I certainly don't want him to die, but if he did die, I think the Tommy Robinson movement would literally be over.
He'll be buried on the Mount of Olives, won't he?
He would. He'd be buried on the Mount of
Olives. Services to Zion.
But it's the same with Britain First. If Paul Golding perished, Britain First would be over. The same with Jada Franson's movement. You know, there's no one else in those movements of any note that anyone knows. You know, the Tommy Robinson movement is Tommy, British Freedom Party is Jada, Britain First is Paul. That's how it is. But I think PA is a lot bigger than that. There are people in PA that are making name for themselves. You know, Laura and Sam, obviously, you know, Laura is very high profile herself. And if something did happen to me, let's say, you know, I was in a car accident or something and it was really serious and I'd got, you know, serious spinal injury or something that's going to take me 6 to 8 months to recover and I couldn't do what I'm doing, I think PA would be in absolutely incredible hands with Laura and the organisation wouldn't suffer. It's as simple as that. Whereas, you know, when the Tommy Robinson movement lost Tommy because he went to prison for a year, what happened to it? Well, it just withered. It withered until he came back out and then it got going again. And I think it would be very remiss of us as an organization to not have other people who are talented. And if you look at all of our regional organizers, they're incredibly talented people. And our regional groups don't just fire into action when me and Laura drive down there and say, right, who's coming out and doing something with us? They act independently. Every week of the year, every weekend of the year, there is something going on with each one of our regional groups, independently of what me and Laura is doing. And that's because PA is more of a community-based organization where the individual regional groups have autonomy. And I think that's very important. So, yeah,
I would speak at street demos, but no, I don't think I need to be the center of attention every time something happens. And I think if I was the center of attention every time something happened, that would actually, in the long term, be very bad for PA. So I think we've answered that question. Rouse yourself from slumber said, can we hear Mark doing a Brummy accent? No, I did that the other week. It was a one-time only gig. Laura, you don't want to hear me do that really irritating Brummy joke again, do you?
Oh, is that your stupid voice?
Yeah.
I hear it quite often, so
yeah, I do mind. That I do that joke to Laura all the time. She's so sick of hearing me doing it, she said she's going to stab me in the eye if I do it again, so better not. Popcorn Power said, what do you think the odds are that Tommy has been fed a fake list of informants? Shall I answer that, Laura?
I mean, I'm not as hopeful as some that this is going to be the big expose.
Shall I answer?
I do hope that he's caught them doing criminal stuff.
Laura, does everyone actually want me to give my thoughts on this? Because it's not 28 days later, but shall I give my thoughts? Well, I'm going to. I sort of did on the kill stream the other night. Right. Hope Not Hate, as far as I'm concerned, is an anti-white, anti-British, neo-Marxist organisation. But you cannot underestimate them and just write them off as a bunch of sort of dopey liberals trying to quote unquote smash the fash, because we know that Hope Not Hate and their predecessor organizations, Searchlight Magazine, have both worked extensively in the past with the security services. That is something that's very serious. And I know this because when I was prosecuted post the 2004 Euro elections, it was Hope Not Hate, the Bradford TUC and the police that colluded to bug meeting rooms, infiltrate the BNP and essentially gather information that led to the prosecution. So we know that Hope Not Hate work with the police and the security services. As such, you would believe quite reasonably that anyone that ended up working for Hope Not Hate would not only be heavily vetted by Hope Not Hate, but would also be vetted to some degree by the security services. Saying that, you would expect the security services would be monitoring Tommy Robinson and people around him, and they would know instantly from their monitoring of those groups if somebody was attempting to infiltrate Hope Not Hate. What's more, and further to this, I would say that anyone that got in with Hope Not Hate and started working for them would be unlikely to receive a full or genuine list of Hope Not Hate informants. Okay? I don't believe that people who start working with Nick Lowles go into the office and sit next to him having a coffee and he's just like, oh, by the way, here's the key to the safe. In the safe, there's a black book with a list of people, with a list of all our informants. You know, if you need it, just put it back after you've used it. I don't think it would work like that. In fact, I would imagine that both the state and its proxies, i.e. Hope Not Hate and Searchlight Magazine, would most likely keep informants or the names of informants very secretive, and most likely informants, as they do with the police, would only work with one contact. So I should imagine a Hope Not Hate informant would have their own handler. So each person who worked for Hope Not Hate and was high enough up the ladder would deal with a number of informants, but those informants wouldn't deal with anyone else. And it would be unlikely that the different people working for Hope Not Hate would all sit around sort of, you know, in Pizza Hut after work, talking about the ins and outs of each one of their informants and sharing their information with each other. And the same is true of the security services. When the security services have an informant, you know, all the different operatives within the security services wouldn't be sat in the cafeteria, you know, drinking their lattes and eating their, you know, state subsidized, you know, ice cream and apple pie, talking in loud voices to each other about which one of their informants is their favorite or who they got the latest info off. Stuff like that is kept on the low for a reason, so that people don't end up in any way, letting information slip that might be heard by somebody else, that might be repeated to somebody else, that then might be repeated to somebody else, that might end up endangering their informants or operations they're working on. And I'm not saying Hope Not Hate is as out and out as professional as, say, Special Branch or MI5 or anybody like that. I'm not saying that they're that professional, but I do believe that they would base their modus operandi on that, and their own internal security on that of the security services that they work with, because I should imagine the security services will have briefed them on how to do things like that, on best practice. And I think that, taking all that into account, do you think, does either of you guys on the panel think I've been unreasonable here?
I do think that Hope Not Hate would not have formal vetting from MI5 or whatever. I think it would be more informal than that, because there wouldn't be an official connection, even if they were to, you know, get linked information from security services or whatever. I do think there could potentially be an opening, but I'm just not hopeful that Tommy's been the one to expose anything significant.
Yeah, well, you see, Mike... Laura, what do you think? Do you think I'm being too harsh on Tommy's expose? Do you think Hope Not Hate would be easy to get into?
No, well, me and Sam, actually, this is going to be one of our topics on Tea Time tomorrow, but it's just a shame that it's coming from someone like Tommy, because I think it's somebody who none of us trust in terms of competency, but also in terms of end goal and, you know, what he's trying to achieve. I mean, he's lied and got caught out and been dishonest in various other ways so much in the past. It's a shame that it's coming from him. But if he can do this, then obviously I 100% support him, because Hope Not Hate are the number one enemy. And then with regards to Hope Not Hate, they're not very intelligent. I mean, they go on about the Order of Nine Angles all the time, like they're some massive threat and it's not just some fed up. So they don't have that much information if they believe that they're a genuine organisation. And I think the information that they pass is sometimes a one-way street, and they don't get stuff back from the government and the police and stuff. So I hope, if Tommy was there for a year, he said that someone was undercover for a year, I hope that, you know, bits of information just slipped out, and maybe Hope Not Hate got sloppy, and maybe people walked into the office, you know, stuff like that. And I hope that there is something there, but I guess we won't know until it comes out.
Well, I agree with Laura. I have my reservations. I think the security services would be monitoring this. And as Hope Not Hate are one of their proxies, I'd be very, very surprised if the security services had allowed anything like this to go ahead. And if it has gone ahead, I should imagine there would be quite a lot of embarrassment, not just from Hope Not Hate, but from people within the establishment who work with them. Secondly, I would also say that, bearing that in mind, there is the potential that Hope Not Hate knew that they had a mole and fed that mole maybe a fake list, or gave him duff information, or even said things to him, getting him to publish it so the people who then published that information could be sued. I don't know. Now, I hope, beyond all hope, that Tommy Robinson has pulled off a blinder. I hope that he is genuinely infiltrated them, and I hope that whoever was in charge of that infiltration project got their hands on their little black book of informants and is going to publish it from cover to cover, and there's going to be a downloadable PDF of it so that we can all go through it and see who are the rats in the wider nationalist movement. It would be incredible to see the people who have in whatever way collaborated with that anti-white organization. However, I'm not going to hold my breath, but it's like with the Elon Musk thing. I said Elon Musk wouldn't end up buying Twitter. I said that. I said I thought it was a pipe dream. I thought people were getting too excited too quickly. And I said I was going to keep a cautious optimism about myself. And obviously now it looks like, unfortunately, I've been vindicated in by saying we should be cautiously optimistic. So when it comes down to it, my what I'm saying about this is it's time for cautious optimism. It's cautious optimism. And if we can keep cautiously optimistic, well, maybe something good will come of it. If nothing good comes of it, well, so be it. But I'm going to stay cautiously optimistic. And I'll say this as well. Tommy Robinson doesn't like me. He said a lot of harsh things about me. But if he has pulled this off and he has pulled off a blinder and he's done the unthinkable, I will be fair to him and I'll take off my cap and say, Tommy, we've had our differences, but well done on this one. I'm certainly not going to be partisan on this. If he has actually pulled this off, I will be very impressed and I will be very, very thankful for his work. But until I've seen everything that's coming out, cautious optimism is what we're going to say. And we've got one last question from Rouse Yourself from Slumber. He said, did you see Mr. One Eye called for Sven Longshanks to be put in prison? Yes. A former nationalist leader in the UK who only has one eye did go on a podcast and attack Sven Longshanks, saying he hopes he's jailed. Pretty disgusting. And I disavow that kind of vile behaviour. Anyway, that brings us to the end of the questions and the stream. X Nobody X gave one Odyssey token, said good stream. Thank you very much. So that is the end. And as it is the end, it is time to give our scores and our final roundup, and then we'll call it a night. And we'll start with you, Laura. Final thoughts and a score out of 10, please.
Okay, well, I'm going to give it 7 out of 10, which might sound high because I've slagged it off.
It really does.
I do think it's a good film. It's just not my type of film. So there's not much that I can criticise apart from the stuff that I have criticised. But I wasn't gripped by it because it's just not my type of film. It's an action film, isn't it? Which I'm not interested in. So, but I do think it was well made. I like the music and, you know, the atmosphere that they created. And apart from the young kid, the acting wasn't too bad. So yeah, I'll give it a 7 out of 10. And will I watch it again? No. But if people like zombie films, it's probably one of the better ones out there. That's it.
Okay, Nativist, score out of 10 and final thoughts, please.
I think it's a gripping film. I think, yeah, apart from Hannah, the acting was excellent in most places, particularly, you know, Cillian Murphy and Christopher Eccleston and Brendan Gleeson as well. Superb performances. I think it's amazing that it was done on such low budget. And, you know, as much as I'm not a liberal and, you know, the second half, particularly the finale has a, you know, a clownish liberal aspect to it. I could still enjoy, you know, certain parts of the film, and overall I'll give it an 8 out of 10.
Wow. Well, I'm going to be the outlier here because usually I'm the one who gives sort of more generous scores. But I'm going to say this. I loved the first half. I thought it was incredible. I thought the camera work, the atmosphere, the music, the storytelling, the establishing shots, everything about the first half up until they get to Manchester is brilliant, other than the irritating female lead who I absolutely couldn't stand. And as zombie films go, I've got to say, this is one of my favourite when it comes to establishing the narrative and for world building. I enjoyed it. In fact, to say I enjoyed it, it's probably a bit of an understatement because I've really talked up the beginning because I really liked it. Now, it is a film of two halves, just like every other zombie film. But my gosh, that second half is just absolute dross. It undoes a lot of the good of the first half. It flips two characters on their head. It's unrealistic. The narrative is terrible. It doesn't make any sense. There's certain continuity errors, such as the way the soldiers use their rifles at first and then how they literally cannot fire a rifle for love nor money, as if they've never even seen a rifle before, as if somebody's just captured, like, you know, some Inuit from the North Pole and said, look, here's a British Army rifle. What do you do with it? And they're like, what? You know, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. I hated the second half. it damaged the film for me. And as such, I'm going to give it 5 out of 10. I'm going to say it gets, you know, it basically, yeah, it gets half marks because half of the film is excellent. The other half is terrible, but there is that running problem of the gobby female who I found detestable. So yeah, if you like a good zombie film, watch this up to the bit where the taxi is making its way to Manchester. Turn it off and just say they all escaped and you've had a great film. And then you'll probably give it 10 out of 10, but don't stick around for the second half. So that's my thoughts. That's everyone's thoughts. We've wrapped up slightly early tonight. Obviously, we've had one less on the panel and we've spent a lot of time talking about politics tonight as well as the film. Next month, we're going to be watching The Children of Men. So please, if you've been one of the people who've been writing to me every week since Film Club started saying, please do Children of Men, please do Children of Men, please do. You don't need to write to me anymore saying that because it's Children of Men. I have finally buckled. It's the film you wanted. It's the film about the Agenda 21 depopulation agenda. It's the film about Brits not being able to reproduce anymore and multicultural Britain literally falling into a hellscape. And we are going to do it for you. I'm actually looking forward to it. It's a film you wanted. And maybe we'll do a Nolan special the month after because a lot of people are asking for a Nolan film. So until then, I'm going to let you all go, but we're going to do our outros first. The lovely Laura Towler, give us an outro, my dear.
Well, thank you for having me. Sorry, I wasn't really invested in the film this month. I just, it's just not my genre. But looking forward to next month. I do like Clive Owen, so yeah, that should be a good one. I'll be back tomorrow with Sam and Alec Yerbury, one of PA Yorkshire's top activists. We're going to be discussing... they went out and they did another protest this weekend. Nobody knows about it yet, but we should have a video of that. And if you want to support me in the work that I do, you can get some tea or coffee from grammartowlers.co.uk. And I'll say good night to everyone and good night to Nativist and Mark. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday evening.
Thank you. Nativist, give yourself a quick outro, my friend.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to next month already. I think it's going to be a bit spicy in relation to current events and perhaps some different views. But well done to all the PA activists. And, you know, if you can afford it, send Laura and Mark a donation for the excellent work. And pack some extra water for the next 2 days because it's going to be swelteringly hot. I personally don't think we're going to get to 40 degrees, but we'll see. And have a good week, everyone.
Well, thank you so much, Nativist. Thank you for being there. Thank you to Laura and thank you to Nativist. And for me, I hope you have a wonderful weekend or whatever left of it. I'll be back on Wednesday with Eric Stryker for PWR. The lineup for this week's PWR changed slightly. As you may have heard, it was going to be the Modern Monarchist, and unfortunately he had to cry off. He's on holiday in Italy, so good for him. But we're having Eric Stryker on, who is absolutely wonderful, so looking forward to that. I hope you enjoyed tonight's stream. I hope the slightly hotter weather isn't literally going to cause an apocalypse, but apparently according to the Daily Mail, thousands will die. Let's see. But you know, do make sure you cope with this slightly warmer weather as best you can. I obviously found that quite amusing at the beginning, but obviously I don't want any harm to come to anyone. So that's that. So thank you to everyone. Thank you to all those who donated, and thank you to all those who tuned in. I hope you enjoyed the stream. And next month it's going to be The Children of Men. So I look forward to that. Stay strong, keep fighting, and I'll see you all again soon. Love you all and good night.